Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. York, this is Democracy Now!
My name is Duncan Kreps. I'm a senior at Middlebury College, and I participated in the Middlebury Solidarity Encampment. Over the weekend, our camp voted to make an agreement with the administration that meant that our encampment came down yesterday in exchange for significant progress on each of the encampment's demands.
As students around the United States set up Gaza solidarity encampments on their campuses, many universities have called in police who've arrested students, sometimes violently, and dismantled the sites. But students at a number of colleges have managed to negotiate agreements where administrators have acceded to some of their demands, including considering divestment from Israel. Today, we're joined by four students from Middlebury College in Vermont, Evergreen in Washington State, Brown University in Rhode Island, and Rutgers in New Jersey. Then we speak with one of over 60 journalism professors who've signed a letter to the New York Times calling on the paper to commission an independent review of a controversial December article alleging Hamas systematically weaponized sexual violence on October 7th.
It was very troubling to professors of journalism to see such a shoddy article be published without a retraction or an investigation. And so it became important for us to write this letter and to send it to the New York Times.
The New York Times has since cut ties with one of the three reporters on the story. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The United Nations warning Gaza could run out of fuel and drinking water today following Israel's seizure of the Rafah border crossing. Israel's facing mounting global pressure not to launch a broader ground invasion of Rafah, where more than 1.4 million displaced Palestinians have sought refuge. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres warned there's no safe place for people in Rafah to go.
Even the best friends of Israel are clear. An assault on Rafah would be a strategic mistake, a political calamity, and a humanitarian nightmare. I appeal to all those with influence over Israel to do everything in their power to help avert even more tragedy.
Doctors in Rafah are warning Israel's seizing of the border crossing and its intensifying attacks on eastern Rafah could lead to thousands of more deaths. Marwan Al-Hams is the director of Abu Yusuf Al-Najjar Hospital in Rafah, which was forced to close and evacuate its patients Tuesday due to Israeli military operations.
The closure of the Rafah crossing means the death of thousands of patients. Thousands of injured will be martyred. Nutritional resources, medical resources, and humanitarian aid won't enter the Gaza Strip, which means more diseases, more patients needing treatment that isn't available, more patients with chronic diseases, new diseases we won't find medication for, and therefore the number of patients will pile up.
The Israeli newspaper Haaretz reports Israel's planning to hand control of the Rafah border crossing to a private U.S. security company. The paper did not name the firm, but said it was made up of veterans of elite U.S. Army units. Meanwhile, the New York Times has confirmed reports the Biden administration withheld sending 3,500 bombs to Israel last week out of fear the bombs could be used to attack Rafah. But the administration's gone ahead with approving another $827 million for other weapons and equipment for the Israeli military. This comes as Politico reports the Biden administration's indefinitely delayed issuing a report to determine whether Israel's violated U.S. and international law in its war on Gaza. Negotiations are continuing in Cairo, 2 days after Hamas agreed to a ceasefire proposal mediated by Egypt and Qatar. On Tuesday, family members of hostages held in Gaza rallied in Tel Aviv. This is Shahar Mor Zahiro, whose uncle Avraham Munder is being held hostage.
We heard from sources involved in the negotiations that the one thing preventing this deal from happening, the one thing separating us from the return of our loved ones, was and remains an Israeli guarantee of an end to this war. To Netanyahu and the government of Israel, we clearly say from this stage, if the only way to get the hostages back is by providing an Israeli guarantee to end this war, then end this war. Bring them back and save their lives.
The police crackdown on peaceful student protesters continues across the United States. In Illinois, police cleared an encampment at the University of Chicago. Here in New York, police forces raided a protest camp at the Fashion Institute of Technology, arresting dozens of protesters Tuesday. Meanwhile, in Europe, police arrested more than 100 activists at University of Amsterdam. Police also dismantled an encampment at Berlin's Free University. Despite the police repression, new encampments continue to form. In Cambridge, Massachusetts, students at MIT restarted a Gaza solidarity encampment. Meanwhile, at the Rhode Island School of Design, RISD, students barricaded themselves inside a campus building, which they renamed Gavin Hall, after the acclaimed Palestinian artist who died after being unable to get care in Gaza. This is Santiago Alvarado of RISD Students for Justice in Palestine.
Fatih Gavin is a Palestinian artist who was martyred after being unable to receive treatment because of the Israeli occupation. And as artists, I believe it's our moral duty to call for an end to genocide.
Here in New York, a local real estate developer was arrested after driving his car into a crowd of pro-Palestinian protesters who'd gathered outside the home of a Columbia University trustee. The driver's been identified as Reuven Kahana. He's a cousin of the late extremist Jewish rabbi Meir Kahana, who publicly advocated for ethnic cleansing of Palestinians. Meir Kahana served one term in Israel's Knesset before he was convicted of acts of terrorism. Meanwhile, in Arizona, a research scholar at Arizona State University named Jonathan Udelman has been placed on leave after he was filmed harassing a woman in a hijab in Tempe. On Tuesday, President Biden spoke at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum's Days of Remembrance. He condemned what he called a ferocious surge of anti-Semitism in the United States.
And my commitment to the safety of the Jewish people, the security of Israel, and its right to exist as an independent Jewish state is ironclad, even when we disagree.
The group Jewish Voice for Peace criticized Biden's speech, saying he, quote, disgraced the memory of the Holocaust by using our history of persecution to justify the Israeli military's genocide of Palestinians, unquote. Meanwhile, on Capitol Hill, Senator Bernie Sanders announced plans to introduce a resolution to condemn bigotry in all forms.
No to anti-Semitism, no to Islamophobia. No to all forms of racism and bigotry.
Adult film star Stormy Daniels testified Tuesday about her brief affair with Donald Trump that's at the center of the criminal hush money case against the former president. Daniels' testimony prompted Trump's legal team to request a mistrial, but Judge Juan Merchan rejected the motion. The judge also ordered Trump to stop audibly cursing during the trial. Meanwhile, in a major development in another Trump case, federal judge Aileen Cannon has indefinitely postponed Trump's trial over his mishandling of classified documents. Cannon, who is a Trump appointee, said there are too many pretrial issues to resolve before a trial date could be set. In Brazil, search and evacuation efforts continue for survivors of catastrophic floods in the southern state of Rio Grande do Sul, as the death toll has reached at least 90 people. Over 130 are still missing. The city of Porto Alegre has been almost entirely cut off by the flooding. The airport and bus stations closed while main roads blocked. Tens of thousands have been left without a home, forced to sleep in the street while others are fleeing to other regions on foot. Survivors are also struggling to find food and other basic necessities. Chinese President Xi Jinping has arrived in Serbia after visiting France, where he began his first European trip in 5 years. Xi arrived in Belgrade on the 25th anniversary of NATO's deadly bombing of the Chinese embassy in Belgrade on May 7, 1999, during the war in Kosovo. The attack killed three Chinese nationals. The state of Florida and the Catholic Medical Association have sued the Biden administration over a new federal rule protecting transgender people from discrimination in healthcare access. The policy was published by the U.S. Health and Human Services Department Monday and draws from an anti-discrimination provision in the Affordable Care Act. Florida law bans gender-affirming care for trans children and youth. And a cleaning company based in Tennessee has been fined over $649,000 after a U.S. Labor Department investigation found it was employing at least two dozen children, some as young as 13 years old, to clean slaughterhouses and meatpacking plants. Fayette Janitorial Service was found to have hired children to work overnight cleaning shifts at times using corrosive materials to clean, quote, dangerous kill floor equipment at facilities in Sioux City, Iowa, and Accomack, Virginia. On Monday, New York Times reporter Hannah Dreyer won a Pulitzer Prize for exposing how thousands of migrant children, most of them from Mexico and Central America, risk their lives working at meatpacking plants and factories. Go to democracynow.org to see our interview with Hannah Dreyer, as well as other Pulitzer winners this year, including Nathan Thrall, Justin Elliott, and Jonathan Eig. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. College campuses around the world have ignited in a global uprising of students protesting Israel's assault on Gaza. From New York to Berlin, San Francisco to Sydney, students have set up Gaza solidarity encampments to call for a ceasefire and to demand that their schools disclose and divest from companies with ties to Israel. Many universities have responded by calling the police onto their campuses to violently break up the encampments. In the U.S. alone, over 2,000 students, faculty, and supporters have been arrested at dozens of universities over the past 3 weeks. But as the campus crackdowns continue, students at a number of universities have managed to negotiate agreements where administrators have acceded to some of the protesters' demands. One of the first was Pitzer College in California on April 1st. Today, we're joined by students from four universities where school administrations have agreed to a number of key demands, such as publicly calling for a ceasefire in Gaza and exploring divestment from Israel. At Brown University, which came to an agreement last week, we're joined by Rafi Ash, a sophomore majoring in urban studies, part of Brown Jews for a Ceasefire Now and Brown Divest Coalition. He's joining us from Providence, Rhode Island. At Middlebury College, which struck a deal on Sunday, we're joined by Duncan Kreps, a graduating senior at Middlebury, where he's majoring in mathematics. He was part of the pro-Palestinian Middlebury Solidarity Encampment, and he joins us from Middlebury, Vermont. At Evergreen State College in Washington, which came to an agreement last week, we're joined by Alex Marshall, a third-year student, joining us from Olympia. Evergreen is the alma mater of Rachel Corrie, the American peace activist killed by Israeli military bulldozer in Gaza, March 16, 2003. And at Rutgers University in New Jersey, we're joined by Asil, a Palestinian student at Rutgers who has family in Gaza. She's part of Students for Justice in Palestine. We welcome you all to Democracy Now! Let's begin at Brown. Rafi Ash, you are a sophomore in urban studies at Brown. Can you talk about the encampment that was set up and then what ensued?
Yeah, so we set up an encampment two weeks ago at this point. And our encampment was on the main green, our central quad on campus. And we set up for 7 days. And while the administration raised its disciplinary threat, it really did not sway students. And as the administration was trying to start set up for commencement, the pressure grew on them to actually begin to either force us out or come to the table. And we were able to force them to the table on Monday of last week, and that led to a multi-day negotiations process. And, I think these negotiations didn't really seem like a possibility before these encampments began. But through them, we were able to actually, push to force a vote on divestment. And that's a vote that's never happened before at Brown, and that's something that we've been pushing for a long time, that our Board of Corporation will first have a more informational session on divestment without a vote, but then followed by, at the meeting after, a guaranteed vote. And, you know, that's not the end of the story. We still have so much more work to do, and we need to make sure that that vote is a yes for divestment. But that was a huge step that came out of an escalatory encampment.
Now, a while ago, there were a number of arrests on campus. There were protests after Hashem Owatani, who is the Brown student who was shot in Burlington, Vermont, when he and two of his best friends from the Friends Academy in Ramallah, who had come to the United States to go to college where their families thought it was safer, was shot by a white man off his porch when they were taking a walk on the way to his grandmother's house. Hashem is now paralyzed. Can you talk about what happened after that and the number of arrests that took place and the administration's response to that? And are there the quashing of those charges also part of this discussion with the administration?
Yeah, so we had last semester 61 arrests on campus, 20 of them in early November before the shooting, and then another 41 in the weeks after Hisham's shooting. And I think there's a it brings it very personal and directly to home that the violence against Palestinians is that our university is currently complicit in through its endowment. Yes, that affects. That is not only affecting Palestinians in Palestine, that also incites violence against Palestinians here and against Brown's own Palestinian students.
So with and, this, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, that this makes it very, very personal and very, you know, essential to so many Brown students to stand up against their administration's violence.
I want to bring Duncan Kreps into the conversation, a senior at Middlebury College at Middlebury, Vermont. Duncan, talk about setting up the encampment and what happened next.
Yeah, we set up our encampment, I guess, early morning, two Sundays ago, and then started engaging with the administration on Tuesday of that following week and had negotiations from there. I think a notable part of our experience is the atmosphere of relative calm that we existed in. We didn't experience the counter protests of many other college campuses, and also our administration decided to not send the police in on its own students, which we want to clarify. We believe is the bare minimum for any administrative response to student activism and free speech.
So talk about the demands and negotiations and who is on the team on both sides, administration and students.
Yeah, we met with the four administrators consistently, representing kind of different aspects of the institution. And then we sent a rotating team of students to kind of spread the burden of those negotiations and also to ensure that various voices are being heard in that room. But all decisions were brought back to the camp and made as a collective.
And the students took down the encampment?
I'm sorry?
The students took down the encampment?
Yes. So we voted to accept an agreement. After six rounds of negotiations, the encampment came down on Monday in exchange for significant progress on all five demands. Our administration agreed to call for a ceasefire, and we also made progress on divestment. The decision to bring down the encampment was a strategic one. We believe that we could assign resources in other ways to continue to put pressure, especially on divestment, and holding the administration accountable to their comments. And we now look towards an upcoming Board of Trustees meeting where divestment will be discussed.
Why do you care about this issue, Duncan? You're a graduating math senior at Middlebury College in Vermont.
Yeah, I don't know how I couldn't. I mean, we see what's happening. We see the invasion of Rafah happening before our eyes. This feels like in many ways, the most horrific thing I've seen happen in my lifetime. And being an American complicit in this and being a student at an institution complicit in this genocide directly, I couldn't imagine standing by and not acting.
Let's go to Alex Marshall, who is across the country, a third-year student at Evergreen State College. Now, Evergreen State College is in Olympia, Washington. It's the home city of the parents of Rachel Corrie. In fact, it's the alma mater of Rachel Corrie. She was set to graduate from Evergreen in 2003 and went to Gaza and stood in front of a pharmacist's home as an Israeli bulldozer was moving in to demolish it. And she was crushed to death by that bulldozer. Alex, can you talk about the protest encampment when it was set up and then what you negotiated with Evergreen authorities, the administration?
Yeah, thank you for having me. So our encampment was established on Tuesday, the 23rd. And negotiations began with administration on the following day, Wednesday, the 24th. There was initially a rotating team of negotiators, but then a second team was established to step in on Sunday, the 28th, and I was a part of that new team. Our demands were formulated through a process of consensus within the encampment, and we focused on divesting from companies that are profiting off of the Israel, off of Palestine, changing Evergreen's grant acceptance policy to no longer accept funding from Zionist organizations that support stifling students' free speech, as well as a police services community review board structure to be created and the creation of an alternative model of crisis response. Evergreen also agreed to prohibit study abroad programs to Israel, Gaza, or the West Bank until the day comes when Palestinian students would be allowed entry. And they also agreed to release a statement calling for a ceasefire and acknowledging the International Court of Justice's genocide investigation.
And who were the people who negotiated on both sides, Alex?
Well, I was on a team of four, and on the administrative side, it was the vice president of the college and the dean of students.
And what do you think was different about your school than places like Columbia, where they called in the police twice?
Well, it being Rachel Corrie's alma mater, I think, is significant. She's been gone for 20 years, but her memory lives on amongst the student body and the Olympia community at large. Craig and Cindy Corrie came to one of our rallies to speak, and I think her memory, you know, I have learned about her. I've read her emails to her parents in multiple classes that I've taken at Evergreen, and her memory being so inspiring in that way. I believe also that Evergreen has an interest in maintaining its image as a college that highly values diversity and acting across significant differences and advocating for students' voices and students' abilities to exercise their rights to freedom of speech, freedom of protest. Evergreen is a small college. The college has had a rough few years after the media storm that occurred in 2017. Administration knew that there would be serious repercussions to Evergreen's image if police were called in. We are extremely grateful that all of our students were safe and we had no arrests and no students have been written up for policy violations. And I think that that really speaks to the culture of Evergreen's student body as one that really emphasizes taking care of each other and fighting for the struggle for justice.
We're going to end with Asil, who is a Palestinian student at Rutgers University in New Jersey, who has family in Gaza. We're only using Asil's first name because she is concerned about doxing. Asil, can you talk about what happened at Rutgers after students set up the Rutgers encampment?
Yeah, hi. So last Thursday, we ended our encampment. It was a four-day encampment. And as a result of our collective efforts, we were able to have the Rutgers administration agree to commit to 8 out of 10 demands, which we are like really, really happy about. And I just also want to know that this encampment in like 3 weeks where we did it was our second encampment. Because we revived Kent State University. That's one. And another thing as well is we are very excited that part of our demands is, number one, that we are going to welcome 10 Gazan students, some of whom we anticipate to be our family members. Another thing is that we are going to finally have Palestinian flags hung. And Holloway is finally going to acknowledge his Palestinian students, finally, and name Palestine and Palestinians in his statements instead of like the Middle East region and the Gaza region. And then not only that, but we are also going to hire additional professors of Palestinian studies, because apparently everyone thinks that this started on October 7th. So I think that's pretty important. Another thing is that we are finally going to have an Arab cultural center. Why didn't we have one before is the real question. We are also going to finally get a Middle Eastern studies department. Again, why did we not have one before? Another thing is that we are going to be granted, hopefully Rutgers commits to this, amnesty and no suspensions for our encampment. And yeah, I hope I'm not missing anything, but it's
one of the standard calls for at these campus encampments has been to disclose and divest. Was that an issue for Rutgers students?
Yes, that was our main reason why we came. We demanded to divest from Israel, from Israeli apartheid and settler colonialism. And also our second most important demand was to end our relationship with Tel Aviv University and close down the construction of the Helix Hub, which is right next to the New Brunswick train station. It should also be noted that Tel Aviv University is not just any university. It is a like very prime component of Israeli apartheid and settler colonialism. They manufacture weapons that basically kill my family in Gaza. Not only that, but they also hold the corpses of like 60 to 70 corpses of Palestinians. Just to like also illustrate how close this hits to home is that one of these corpses is the cousin of our beloved professor, Noura Araket. And they basically refuse to give back these corpses, these bodies to Palestinian families. We unfortunately were not able to get these agreements. However, we did get an agreement to have a meeting with the Joint Committee on Investments, with the Board of Governors, with President Holloway for divestment, which is a process to divestment. So this is incredible progress in our eyes and to everyone's eyes, I think, because we have been asking for a meeting for 5 years and we finally got one. And that's why we decided to not get arrested, to leave basically the encampment and shut it down, because we got the meeting, we got the aid demand, and we believe that these are just like increment steps towards divestment. But more than willing to get arrested. We were actually prepared for it, but we decided not to.
Asil, mentioned your family. I wanted to end by asking about your family in Gaza. How are they?
Yeah, so they are not okay. 100 members of my, nearly like 100 members, I think. We don't know exactly because of Netanyahu's psychological warfare of cutting down the electricity and cellular devices to be able to honestly reach them. But nearly 100 of my members were martyred. Obviously, I still have family left. I'm still in contact with them, but they are all displaced. Our family homes basically destroyed. Even photos like just show that, like, on the walls say blame Hamas. And it should be noted that none of my family members are in Hamas, have nothing to do with them. And yeah, like, even the photos of Gaza are just unrecognizable. I can't even tell, like, where anything is anymore.